It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in the midst of a spate of gun violence in Milwaukee, our guest says the governor and Milwaukee's mayor should convene a summit on violent crime. Milwaukee has had a bad run so far this year when it comes to violent crime and gun violence in particular. Local leaders and police officials have been looking for solutions and calling on state lawmakers for help, but there's been some pointed partisan debate over the causes and solutions for gun violence.
Our next guest writes that it's time to get past partisan differences and get all parties to the table and to come up with answers. The first step, a summit on violent crime brought together by Governor Scott Walker and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett.
Ernie Franzen joins us now. He's associate editorial page editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote an editorial titled Governor Scott Walker, Mayor Tom Barrett, Call a Summit on Crime. Ernie, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you, Rob. Appreciate your inviting me to talk.
Well, let's start getting a sense of the scope of the problem. How bad has violent crime gotten in Milwaukee, especially so far this year?
So far this year, the homicides are at 48 compared with 17 last year. That's a pretty it's like 170% increase. Non-fatal shootings are also up about 27%, I'm told. There's been a, and in that case, there's been a sort of a steady rise over the last few years in the number of non-fatal shootings. So there is simply too much gun violence on the streets of Milwaukee. And it's not, obviously it's not everywhere, but it's in certain neighborhoods. And those people certainly deserve a lot better.
So one possible silver lining, if we want to go looking for one, is that this could lend a sense of urgency to find solutions. Do you see that sense of urgency in local leaders, communities in the city?
Yeah, I think so. You certainly have urgency from the mayor and from Chief Flynn. Excuse me, I apologize for a cough I have. And there are lots of different things going on, lots of efforts in the neighborhoods, I think. Churches are getting involved. It's a matter of concern to everybody. The call for the summit was to, we hope, get a united strategy going so that people are on the same page. They're talking about the same issues. Obviously, this is a complex problem. We had a story a couple of weeks ago by our reporters Ashley Lutheran and Gina Barton that described in pretty good detail just how complex this is. This is education and jobs and poverty. When the chief talks about this issue, he says that his strategy is designed to look at those neighborhoods where the shootings are taking place, and there's a confluence of things going on in those neighborhoods. I mean, you have the most violence, you have the most poverty, the most foreclosures, most joblessness. That's all happening in certain areas, and these are not unrelated issues. So everybody has to be at the table. Everybody has to be on the same page in terms of what strategy you come up with to deal with that.
Well, looking at the everybody you just mentioned, the mayor, Tom Barrett, talking about this, police chief mm-hmm. Flynn. But in this editorial, you say you want to see Governor Walker involved,
yeah, sure.
Not just involved, but, an orchestrator of this crime summit. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think the state has a big role to play in terms of the not only the bully pulpit that Walker could bring to this, but also in terms of the aid that the city gets from the state. That any cooperative efforts for jobs and for education will have to have a state element, we think. So Walker and Barrett, it would be nice to see them both at the head of the podium or at the head table talking about these issues and calling this all together.
And who else should be at the table? The governor, the mayor, who else do you want to see involved in this effort?
Well, we talked about in the editorial, we talked about the police chief, obviously, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the state attorney general, key lawmakers. I'd like to see Robin Voss there and Scott Fitzgerald, as well as Peter Barca and Chris Larson from the state. Local leaders, Chris Abley, I would think, should be there, even though the county doesn't have a lot to do with Milwaukee street crime. And for that matter, the sheriff should be there, too, Sheriff Clark. But also, leaders from the courts, from business, civic groups, churches, charities, all those people need to be there.
So you've got a mayor who ran for governor as a Democrat, some other Democrats on the local level, a governor who's a Republican. You mentioned some of the legislative leaders, Republicans. Do you see the partisan divide maybe standing in the way of working together on these violent crime issues?
Yeah, sure. I mean, everybody sort of, and that's, I think, part of the problem with the piecemeal approach that's happening now. everybody wants to blame everybody else. You know, not many people really want to take responsibility for it. It's sort of left to the police, and police can't do it alone. The politics need to be set aside. They need to recognize that this is not a political issue. This is an issue of too many guns in the wrong hands. And we're not talking about taking guns from people who should have them, hunters and so on. That's not the issue here. The issue is too many guns in the hands of young men who think that gun violence is a way to settle their disputes. And in the crossfire, kids get killed, innocent bystanders get killed. Something has to be, you know, something has to, that's not a partisan issue. That is an issue for all of us.
We're talking to Ernie Franzen with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board, looking at an editorial piece titled Governor Scott Walker, Mayor Tom Barrett Call a Summit on Crime.
We continue our conversation now with Ernie Franzen. He says Governor Scott Walker and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett should hold a summit on violent crime in the state and set aside partisan differences to look for solutions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to turn things around on violent crime in Milwaukee and elsewhere? If you live in a neighborhood that's been affected by crime and violence, how does that affect your community? What needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. To your calls in just a moment. But Ernie, first, you mentioned trying to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. Other things you'd like to see on the agenda at this hypothetical summit?
Well, it should be addressed also as a public health issue. I mean, one person, you asked me who should be at the table, and I think one person who should be there Stephen Hargarten at the Medical College of Wisconsin, who has done some work on this, on urban violence as a public health issue. You know, the pressures of living in those kinds of neighborhoods are intense, and I can't imagine them. And I can't imagine how a young man or a young woman or a family deals with that on a daily basis. So you need to address that issue. And I think the public health approach is one thing that can certainly help focus our attention and help focus our efforts on how to deal with that. You also asked about the state involvement. You know, one thing I want to point out is that in 2004, and this is from the editorial, Milwaukee received $240 million in shared revenue and spent $179 million on police services. 2015, that number is $227 million in aid, and the city is spending $248 million on police. It's a reduction of $13 million, and that's not an equation that's going to solve the problem.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Robert on the line in Madison. Robert, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, honestly, my honest opinion as an African-American male, I think that the proposal for a gun violence summit comes at a very interesting time, given the fact that the entire nation, and probably the entire country, world, is looking at America and saying, shaking his finger and nodding his head and saying, what is going on to the treatment of African-American males by the police? So I think that, with that being said, the proposal for a gun summit is a ploy to take the attention and needed discussion that could happen away from those authorized to use guns and who are misusing them by killing numerous black and brown men and women. So I think that this conversation about a gun violence summit is not what the world is looking at and the current situation.
Robert, I just want to ask, with 40-some homicides in Milwaukee not related to police violence, is there room to talk about both the police and African-American issues and these homicides? Aren't they both worthy of talking about?
I think that the most devastating and impactful and shakening homicides are those by police. Gun violence, you know, in the, to all communities has continued to happen. So my question to you is, why now?
Robert,
why now do we have a gun violence summit?
Robert, thanks for the call. Ernie, pay more attention, let me, saying to police violence.
That's certainly an important issue that, that the nation has to deal with, that, that Milwaukee police have to deal with, and other departments as well. But again, this summit is not about necessarily about let's say strictly related to gun violence. It's related to a whole slew of issues that and that include police and citizen relations. I think in most, maybe I'm overstating this, and maybe I'm the wrong guy to ask about this, but I think in many cases, police and people in the neighborhoods work together. Yes, there are certainly have been tragic incidents and excesses, but the rate, I mean, the murder rate in Milwaukee from homicides is at 7.18. In Boston, it's 0.11. Why that difference? We need to get our hands on that, as well as deal with how the police and the community work together to address those issues.
Well, do these incidents of police-involved shootings, the death of Dontre mm-hmm. Hamilton, Milwaukee, a part of what you want to see happen is the community groups working with the police, do these put them on opposing sides enough that it's hard to build those bridges and work together?
Well, sure, it's hard to do that. And there's a very strong, there are very strong feelings on both sides. And we sort of need to get past that, I think, at least to talk to each other about that relationship, about race, and about all those other issues we've been talking about. Yeah, that's tough. But, you know, if we don't do it, it's going to get worse.
Now, this gun violence summit, as we've said, is an idea, or not gun violence, this violence summit is an idea.
Right.
Are you hopeful that, in addition to the local leaders getting involved, at least some of the people you want to see at the state level will come to the table, whether it's for a formal summit or more informally, and try to tackle mm-hmm. this problem as a team?
I mean, I'm hopeful. I don't think Republicans in the legislature are bad guys, I don't think they're conducting a war against Milwaukee, or that they don't want to see these problems solved. Everybody wants to see these problems solved. So I think if they can put politics aside, and that's not going to be easy for either side, yeah, I think they could come together and they could at least start talking about these issues together at one table.
Ernie,
if they can do it about the Bucks, they can, you know, they can do it about this.
Ernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
That's Ernie Franzen. He's associate editorial page editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The editorial he was the main writer for, calling for a summit on violent crime, is linked on our Central Time Facebook page.
Now, they may be tiny, but they're unsung heroes when it comes to our health. Our next guest looks at the latest research into the incredible role played by microbes in our digestive systems and beyond.
Check it out. There are up to 10 times more microbe cells, apparently, in our bodies than actual human cells. And new research shows they might affect measures of health ranging from digestion to sleep, obesity to disease immunity.
Here with us now is Rob Knight, professor of pediatrics and computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego. He's the co-founder of the American Gut Project and the author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
So here it is, the year 2015. It seems as though we have advanced quite a ways. So how is it that we've missed the importance of gut microbes so far?
Well, they all look pretty much the same under the microscope. So it's only the fact that DNA sequencing dropped in cost by a factor of almost a million over the last 15 years that lets us really find out about all these microbes at the level that we need to, that is in their DNA rather than just visually.
Well, let's have a little gut microbe 101 here. What exactly are they, and what do they do?
Well, the microbes in your gut, broadly speaking, consist of the bacteria, the archaea, the fungi, the viruses, and then if you're not feeling too good, maybe Giardia and other microbial eukaryotes. What they're doing in general is all kinds of things like helping you digest food, helping your immune system, feeding the cells that line your gut, all kinds of things like that.
But you just listed things like viruses. Aren't viruses bad?
Some viruses are bad. Viruses that attack bacteria that are harmful to you are good for you, though, even if they're bad for the bacteria they attack.
Now, you make the argument that microbes might be more important to our health than every gene in our genome. How is that possible?
They have a lot more genes than we do, and if you take something like obesity, I can tell you with 90% accuracy whether you're lean or obese based solely on the microbial genes that you harbor. So you might be thinking, hey, wait, that's not that impressive. I can tell if I'm fat by looking in a mirror. But if I knew every gene in your human genome, I could only tell if you were lean or obese with about 60% accuracy based on your human genes versus 90% accuracy based on your microbial genes. We're finding out that the same kind of thing is true for all kinds of other diseases.
What kind of other diseases are we talking about?
So other things that microbes have been linked to include things like cirrhosis, rheumatoid arthritis is affected by microbes in your gut, ability to metabolize different drugs, so that's not really a disease, but it might affect your health, including drugs like the active ingredient in Tylenol linked back to your microbiome. And then in mice, at least, so we don't yet know whether this applies as well to humans, but in mice, microbes even determine things like how happy or depressed you are, determine things like whether you show symptoms related to autism, and we're still trying to figure out whether that's true in humans as well. But the idea that microbes play a tremendous number of roles in our bodies and even affect our minds is getting more and more evidence just over the...
And Rob, are you still with us? Looks like we have lost Rob for the moment. We're going to try to get him back as we talk about gut microbes right now. We are learning about these tiny organisms in our gut, roughly speaking, and how science thinks they have an increasingly important role in our health. We're just talking there about some links to possibly obesity, other illnesses that we're working on, and mental health as well. And let's see, Rob Knight, are you back with us?
Yep. I don't know what happened there.
Perfect. Well, we're talking a bit about all the effects that gut microbes have, but why? Do we know why they have such a profound effect on our health, what the function is?
We're still just beginning to understand why, and there's many different things that they can do. Sometimes they're producing metabolites that get into your bloodstream and can interact with your cells to change the pattern of gene expression and change your health. Sometimes they're signaling through your nervous system. Sometimes they're signaling through your immune system. So there's really a lot of different things they can do. And the mechanisms are just now being worked out on a case-by-case basis.
Now, we hear a lot about encouraging healthy flora in our gut. And if you go to a health food store, Walgreens, a drugstore, whatever you have, you can buy probiotics, for instance, which are supposed to encourage a healthy gut. Is that the right thing to do? Is that what we mean when we talk about healthy gut flora?
Well, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm for probiotics, and there's been some clinical trials where specific probiotics have been shown to be good for specific conditions, like, for example, for irritable bowel syndrome or for diarrhea after you've taken antibiotics. But it's kind of like asking, are chemicals good? You know, some drugs are good for some diseases, but the average chemical that you find on the shelf at Walgreens, you probably don't want to take irrespective of which particular condition you have. So you want to think about probiotics the same way. There are some bugs that you can treat as though they were drugs and are going to be useful for particular conditions, but it's more difficult to make blanket recommendations. Now, that said, links between fermented food and health have been widely believed by a lot of people, including many traditional cultures, and so there's probably something to it, although that's very different from thinking that a particular yogurt or a particular bug is going to be a cure-all for anything.
Looking down the road, though, do you see a time when we prescribe a microbe that's prescriptive for a specific ailment?
Well, absolutely. And so, for example, for irritable bowel syndrome, there have been some clinical trials that have been very encouraging already. And similarly, a lot of doctors will prescribe probiotics, particular probiotics for things like recovering from diarrhea. One of the fascinating things is Clostridium difficile associated disease. So there are cocktails of microbes in clinical trials right now that are very effective at treating that particular illness. And so I think we're going to see that kind of thing on the market very soon.
One thing that we've been hearing a lot about in the news, the medical news, is antibiotics having perhaps resistant strains of antibiotics out there and some of the dangers that can come along with that. Is that something that you think that we should be concerned about for a whole different reason, and that is our gut flora?
Absolutely, and there's evidence that especially early life antibiotics has a tremendous effect on the gut bacteria later on, including things like promoting illnesses that we now know are linked to our gut bacteria, including asthma, allergies, even obesity. And so the overuse of antibiotics, both in terms of direct effects on our health, as well as promoting the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that could then kill us, is of tremendous concern. And especially using antibiotics in livestock, that really promotes antibiotic-resistant bacteria that can then cause problems for humans and hospitals.
In your TED Talk, you talk about your colleague. You were charting the gut bacteria of this colleague's child from birth to, I think, the age 2.5, and even that child had to take one course of antibiotics. Is it unrealistic to think that we could live in an antibiotic-free society?
It's unrealistic to think we could live in an antibiotic-free society because antibiotics certainly save lives, and when they're medically necessary, you definitely need to take them. But you want to think about it more in terms of minimizing your use of antibiotics. And a lot of things that people take them for, like, for example, ear infections, there's actually very little evidence that they help with that, as opposed to some of the life-threatening illnesses that you really need to prescribe them for.
Now, lately, we've heard more about therapies like fecal transplants. So that's not usually a phrase that anyone's really happy to hear. It doesn't sound very pleasant. But on the other hand, this sounds like something that has real potential to help people. Can you tell us what a fecal transplant is and how it might work?
Sure, absolutely. So if you think of your gut bacteria as being like an organ in your body, it's the only organ that you can actually transplant without surgery. And essentially what you're doing is you're taking the fecal bacteria from one person, putting them into another person. So there's two routes that you can go with that. Our clinical collaborators who actually do the transplants call those the northern and the southern routes, respectively. And both of them are up to 95% effective for the special case of Clostridium difficile-associated disease. So C. diff kills 14,000 people a year in the United States alone. It's one of the most common hospital-acquired infections. So essentially, what you're doing is you're making a stool smoothie, and either taking it in through a feeding tube that goes through the nose and into your stomach, or you can also do it via colonoscopy. And one of the big questions at the moment in the field is for how many of these other diseases that we now know are linked to the microbiome, everything from inflammatory bowel disease to rheumatoid arthritis. And even if the mouse model data hold up, things like depression and autism could potentially be treated either by that kind of therapy or by transplanting in more specific bugs rather than transplanting everything in a stool sample.
It's fascinating stuff. Before we let you go, how fast do you think we could start to see targeted therapies for diseases, maybe obesity, maybe other diseases based on microbes?
Well, for C. diff, this product in phase 3 clinical trials at the moment. For obesity, the research is a bit further off, but I'd say that clinically validated microbiome-based therapies are probably going to show up within the next 5 to 10 years for a whole range of different conditions. And what's really exciting about obesity, a French group showed just a couple of years ago that you could actually predict who was going to gain weight, who was going to stay the same, and who was going to lose weight on a clinical weight loss diet based on the microbes they had beforehand. So I think those kinds of tests to figure out how you're going to respond to diet, to exercise, to drugs, and so forth, might be on the market even sooner and even before therapies that are based on the microbiome.
Rob, thanks so much for talking today.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
That was Rob Knight, professor at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of Follow Your Gut, The Enormous Impact of Tiny Microbes.